Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's broadcast of Alchemy of Light, and welcome to the show. This show is a celebration and exploration of consciousness, and my name is Jamil Graham. I'm your host, and today we are launching the new world with a very special guest, Amy Vickers from the Star Child Project. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me, Jamil. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, I'm very, very happy to have you with us. And what a fun day to have you, too. I was just made aware this morning by some very bright young 11 and 12-year-olds that this was the end of the world. I said, oh, yeah, tell me about that. And they said, oh, well, you know, the TV said that this is the end of the world. And they said, but, you know, the world never ends, really, does it? And I said, I don't think so. And they said, no, we don't think so either. I was like, well, thank you for bringing me up to date. And wouldn't it be cool if the world ended now anyway? We could just start a new one, and let's do that. Let's start a new one. And what a great day to have this conversation. Go ahead.
I think that the end of the world is actually officially supposed to happen right when this show ends. So, you know, if just in case the... let's say the alternative viewpoints out there that think the world is going to end today arise, then you're going to get the last word in the world. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, that's cool. And if it's a little early, we might rapture together. That can be really fun too. What a riot. Our world is fantastic. I mean, we have so many colors, don't we not?
Oh, absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, welcome. And I am very pleased to welcome you and the knowledge of the Star Child Project and the Star Child Skull, the implications of what does that mean that we actually have a skull of a being that did not originate here on planet Earth, and how does that change our view of the world now that we're new and it's official? Let's bring that in. Would you like to please introduce yourself however you feel comfortable in your history, your story with the Star Child Project, and also please introduce to our listeners what the Star Child Skull is. Can you tell us all a little bit about what that is?
Well, as our wonderful host said, my name is Amy Vickers. I am the Chief of Operations in the Star Child Project, which is an informal group of researchers who've been investigating a very unusual skull called the Star Child Skull since 1999. I've been with the project for about 7 years, and I'm the second most senior member. And so I have been absolutely in the loop on everything that's happened recently. We've had our most exciting discoveries recently. But so that you all know what we're talking about, the Star Child Skull is highly, highly unusual. It is human-like, but nothing about the skull is actually like human skull. It is made of bone, but that bone is about half as thick, weighs half as much, but is twice as strong as human bone. It's vaguely shaped like a skull, but nothing like our skull. Our brains wouldn't fit in it. Our sinuses wouldn't fit in it. Our ears wouldn't fit in it. Everything about this skull is different from what a human skull ought to be. And yet, there is some human or very human-like DNA inside the skull. So we have something here that is truly unique, truly never been seen before. The most recent DNA evidence that we've uncovered leads us to believe that it actually is a genuine alien. It doesn't match any of the DNA previously recovered in any organism anywhere on planet Earth. We really do have something here that can prove definitively that there was alien life on planet Earth at least once 900 years ago. It lived here, it died here, and the aliens didn't come and blow us all up because one of them died here. It's a really, truly amazing thing that we have right now.
Well, thank you. And to take it from there, the Star Child Skull being an anomaly, would you visit for us the conversation of its potential origins? In the ebook, it is suggested very strongly that it perhaps is a gray with the most likeness. And what is your understanding awareness of different extraterrestrial races that our friend the Star Child Skull might belong to?
Well, as I'm sure your listeners know, there are multiple different extraterrestrials that are described by different people, everything from reptilians and insectoids to the Pleiadians and Anunnaki types, which supposedly look very, very much like a human. The Starchild skull has a very oddly shaped head. When you see those depictions of the grey aliens where they have those kind of oddly shaped bulbous heads, often with a crease down the middle like the communion cover, or like your typical I want to believe poster type alien, that's your grey alien. And that really honestly is the closest physiologically to the Starchild skull. It looks more like that than it looks like a human. It has these bizarre shallow eye sockets, has this tiny, tiny narrow lower face, this incredibly enlarged cranium. Really, it does look, as you said, just like a grey alien in all of our forensic depictions that they've done. They've had a really hard time trying to squish a human mold onto the top of the Starchild skull. It just doesn't work because it simply is not human.
Now, the in your process, if you feel comfortable, please share with us about how you understand the possibility, the reality of extraterrestrials and planet Earth. I mean, how has it affected you to integrate this understanding? You know, you've held the skull perhaps even and really communed with it. The energy of that skull still holds the energy of that being. And in your consciousness, when you first came to the project, were you nervous about the idea of extraterrestrials? Were you interested? Have you had any encounters with extraterrestrials? What has your process been in your own consciousness of understanding that we do share the planet with other beings from other parts of the universe?
That's actually a really interesting and important question, because everybody has their own process of coming to terms with this kind of information. And when I came on board with the project, there was a lot of evidence that indicated this is probably an alien or maybe a human-alien hybrid, but we didn't have the absolute rock-solid, this definitely is not from planet Earth kind of DNA evidence that we have now. So at the time, it was a very strong possibility, but there was no proof of it. And I came to the project with a background in archaeology, actually with a strong background in Christian faith. And my first contact was with Lloyd Pye, who's the head of the project. He's the person that first began these scientific investigations back in 99. And before he came to the Starchild skull, he had written a book titled Everything You Know Is Wrong, which is actually a really enlightening distillation of one theory, I think a very good theory with a lot of evidence behind it, of how aliens fit into the human family tree, what they mean to us, how it all happened. And he took in his book a lot of the work of Zechariah Sitchin and melded with that his own research, where he said that aliens are out there, planet Earth was very likely seeded by aliens, where life was put here deliberately. And there, it sounds far-fetched for anyone that isn't a fan of this theory, but there certainly does seem to be some very unusual events in the history of planet Earth, where at each stage, right about when the environment was able to handle a new kind of life, all of a sudden that life was just there like magic. And if you were trying to terraform, if you were trying to invent a planet and put life on it, that's exactly how you or I or anyone would go about doing it, just like preparing the soil in your garden and then planting something. So according to this theory called intervention theory that Lloyd Pye has, let's say, expanded on, he said that there were primates. Everything did happen kind of the way that the mainstream said it did up to a certain point. You get through to your Miocene apes, you know, the very, very gorilla and monkeyish versions of human ancestors, still moving primarily on four legs. And what you have is aliens, in this case Anunnaki, that come and they take genetic material from those very, very, very early pre-humans, and they mix it with their own genetic material and create a being that's somewhere in the middle, and that is apparently us. It is the much later pre-humans, and it is humans the way that they are now. And so with that in mind as a background, it was easier for me to wrap my head around the idea that there was indeed an actual living alien on planet Earth within the last 900 years, and that this is its actual skull that I can see and touch. And it really was a huge shift for me. I had a period of about a week, I think, where I didn't really want to get out of bed. It was just such a shock, and it was such an enormous shift for me to try and take on board. But seen in the broader context, it made more sense to me than if someone had just said, okay, here's an alien and think what you will. It gave me a framework that I could understand everything inside of.
Ah, that's interesting. That's fascinating, even. In the framework of a seated human, can you share with us a little bit more of the details of that? What is a seated human? How did a human happen before it was seated? Or do you know what I'm saying?
That's something that we really just don't get into because we don't have an answer for it yet. Life started somewhere, and
right.
I don't know where it started from. It's a lot easier to take something that's already there and manipulate it. That's what we do now with our genetic engineering. No one has ever been able to recreate a Big Bang moment or a lightning bolt hitting the primordial soup moment where life suddenly starts. We really don't have an explanation for that. It's just a big realm of speculation, and I think that at that point you need to start having some faith and start thinking there's something out there that I just can't understand.
Yeah, in the conversation of genetic engineering, it is an ongoing reality that we are all genetically engineered. I kind of got a lightning bolt of something trying to help me understand that even Monsanto, the beast that they are, they're doing the natural process of what and how we've all come to be who and what we are in the physical form. But then there's this other part that actually brings life to these beings, and that I would call our souls. And have you visited that in your process of understanding what makes a human go? Because the human, without the soul or without the spirit or whatever you call it, doesn't go anywhere. It turns right back to the earth. And so what in this process of understanding how an alien, a being from, we call them aliens, I'm so ready for a whole new dictionary. I mean, we're all family, right? I mean, they just come from somewhere else. And, you know, our soul being chose to incarnate here is kind of where I'm going. So how do you integrate in your understanding now that there are beings, there are physical forms that are inhabited by beings from other parts of the universe, if that's what I'm understanding you saying, then how do you separate out the being part, the part that brings life, that animates these entities?
Well, there's actually a whole big can of worms that I've never found a good explanation for. Several years ago, I read an article, and I'm sure you could probably find it on the internet again if you looked hard enough. But it was from an old medical journal, and it described people who, when they die, when they're autopsied, they're found not to have a brain. In some cases, they have a very, very tiny vestigial brain, but basically their skull cavity does not have a brain in it. These aren't people of really low intelligence necessarily. Some of them were, but some of them were absolutely normal people walking and talking and holding down jobs and doing normal things and living without a brain whatsoever. And we think of our brains as being the thing that makes us who we are. It supposedly gives us our personality and dictates what hormones our body puts out and all kinds of other things. So reading that article really made me think, well, if your brain isn't what makes you who you are, what is it that makes you the person that you are? Is there something else out there? Is it a one-size-fits-all solution? Or is it maybe different for some people, where some of us maybe have such a strong spirit or something else that we don't understand yet, that they don't need the brain and others of us do? Really, this is an area that there is so little understanding of at any level. It's really hard to just give a straight answer on a radio show like this.
Yeah, appreciate you trying, because it really, I feel like in our new consciousness that we're birthing and to bring in the universe community, it it sits on that nerve. The whole idea even of the end or of death or whatever, it suggests something is coming to a close and something is beginning, whether that's your mortal body or your embracing of a larger community or whatever it is, your thoughts, your understanding, your belief systems. So it kind of leans on in that all the way around. And you're right, it's a can of worms. I love that can of worms. I want to open that baby. I do. I want to just open that right up and just have a look inside there. You know, we could have some fun with that. I really think we could have some fun. But let's stay with the welcoming the universe community, the understanding or embracing the idea, just simply starting with the idea that we live in a populated universe. And how do you see us, how do you see that as a benefit in, how can that help us to bring this awareness into us? And how can we move through our fear about that? Can you offer some tips about how we could, you know, rectify the fear and that initial, oh my God, you know, how could that be? Because we lose a lot of really good minds right there, you know?
We really do. And NASA just within the past couple of months announced that they'd found a new planet that they were almost certain would have life on it, because it was in what they called the Goldilocks zone, the not too hot, not too cold, probably has water on it, very similar to Earth kind of state for being a planet. And everyone got all excited about it. I remember way back years ago when they thought they'd found life from Mars, little tiny microscopic fossilized snails from Mars that had arrived on Earth in a meteor that I think was later found to be something else. But it's always something that intrigues people. It makes people excited when they think there's something way out there that doesn't impact me right now, but it's out there and it's cool and I know about it, so I'm special. People like that. They don't necessarily like an alien knocking on their door and saying, hi, I'm going to change everything because I'm more advanced than you. And that's the fear that everyone has. Look at the movies that we've got, Independence Day and War of the Worlds and all of these other things that feed into that fear, when the reality of it is, if aliens are out there and it's kind of a Star Wars universe where they're really super advanced and we're like an ant colony by comparison to the amount of technology that they have, if they were really unhappy with us, I think they probably would have blown us up already. I think if we were in any kind of imminent danger, we wouldn't be around long enough to know it. I think that if they had that level of technology, we'd be gone as already. I think the Starchild skull is 900 years old. It was found in the 1930s, but the being died 900 years ago, plus or minus 40 years. That's the date given to us by radiocarbon dating. If there was some big horrible thing that would happen to us, if an alien died on this planet, it probably would have happened 900 years ago and we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. I think all of these fears about them coming and wanting to dominate the planet, or if one of them comes here and something bad happens to it, they're going to come and blow us up in retribution. All of these fears are so unfounded. It's just juvenile fear-mongering by people who either don't understand it or who are afraid that their position of power is going to be altered by this knowledge, and so they make people afraid to accept it so that they can maintain their perceived position of power. It's just ridiculous. I think the odds of another civilization being out there and making the effort to find us and making the effort to figure out how to communicate with us, because, I mean, it would be like us probably trying to communicate with a goldfish, to go through all of that and then at the end of the day say, oh, I'm just going to blow these people up. I just don't see that happening. I think that is maybe a petty and vindictive and violent streak that we have on this planet, that I don't think you can obtain a certain level of technology if you have that kind of social propensity toward being violent and toward being vicious. I think that we're much more likely to find, if anything, people out there who are basically ignoring us because we're so badly behaved in the grand scheme of things. Why would they want to interact with us? Why would they bother trying to do anything bad to us? I think the fear is just wildly unfounded.
And could you visit the Well, the understanding that an alien or, quote, a being from another part of the universe would be more intelligent than the human, and why we should, why would that be a bother to us? And why would we want to hold on to an idea that is no longer serving us in that light anyway? Perhaps you could offer a little bit about how you turned in your process. It sounds like you're much more open in general to the whole understanding. And, you know, I wonder sometimes if we should not even worry about the people who aren't open and just love them and leave them on the dock, you know, and just, like, get on with this world that we know we can create.
I agree with you. I think that there are people who, no matter what we do and what we say, they're going to believe whatever they want to believe. And at some point, we have to just say, live and let live. I'm going to educate myself. And so long as you're not going to do anything to hurt me, feel free to believe whatever crazy thing you want.
Because it seems to me we could use some intelligence. We obviously are doing a very good job of blowing ourselves up and creating a tremendous environmental disaster that is just astronomical in its proportions. And we have the accompanying ignorance that just exacerbates it. So I think it would be really nice to have some real steady friendships developing and ongoing interaction with intelligent beings that might actually not only help us grow in our technology, but help us grow in our soul and our understanding that we are a part of the universe community and that we do have lives that matter and we do make a difference. And do you see these as potential gifts that interacting with a universe community more appropriately would bring us, and how might we welcome them? Do you have you ever thought about that? How could we welcome them? How could those of us who are open make a place for them, invite them to tea, you know?
Well, I think for a start, they've definitely been here before. I think it's important to understand that there is more than one type of extraterrestrial being out there. Even if just a tiny, minute fraction of all of the eyewitness reports are accurate, within those reports, there are substantial differences between the types of beings that are seen. And I think that it's natural that some of them are going to have different personalities than others. I think that in general, for example, reptilian-type aliens are considered to be more aggressive and a little more scary, and maybe you wouldn't necessarily want to invite that particular type to tea with you. But then you have things like the Pleiadians, which are supposedly very, very human-like. The Starchild skull is going to be a tricky one because it's hard to know exactly what it is. It certainly looks a lot like a gray-type alien. It has substantially more brain than a human would, so that feeds into your question of whether they're more intelligent than we are. But based on the information that we already have, I mean, there is a mountain of speculation, but just based on what we already know, going back to the very first written language, which was that of the ancient Sumers, which are a people that populated the modern-day Iraq-Iran region, they were the very first society to invent a system of writing, and they left a lot of written records. What they would do is they would write things into wet clay and then fire the clay. That's where we get the expression written in stone. These clay tablets were fired into like stoneware and they were able to survive centuries. The writing is still very clear. It's not like something written on a papyrus where the odds of getting anything useful are slim to none. Whatever these tablets were able to recover are still legible. They're still very clear. And Zechariah Sitchin actually educated himself in how to read that language so that he was able to translate many of these tablets that had not yet been translated. And from his works, he said that the aliens that created humans created us to basically be a worker species for them, to be someone to help them mine gold on planet Earth. And this feeds back into your statement about our damage to the environment and the ecology. The reason, according to these tablets, that they wanted gold, that these godlike alien beings wanted gold in the first place, was because they had damaged their ozone layer within their planet, and they needed gold to repair the ozone layer. The theory being that if you turn the gold into a microfine powder and then shoot it into the upper atmosphere, it will actually reflect a lot of the sun's radiation and effectively put a patch over the ozone hole. This is something where he translated this, and years later, scientists came out and said, you know, we could repair our ozone layer with gold if we needed to. And fortunately, they changed the laws, and we stopped using a lot of the greenhouse gases that were damaging the ozone layer, and so it kind of fixed itself without needing to resort to the gold strategy. But this is what's written, that these beings have already been there and done that, and they know the dangers of harming your environment, and they came up with a solution, and they came here, and they basically created us to help them in that solution for their planet. And then at the end of the day, they just kind of left us here and said, okay, it's time to leave the nest. Go off and do your own thing now.
That's interesting. Do you know where it progressed from there? And the Sumerian tablets, when were they approximately, at what point, how many years back?
Unfortunately, this is not my area of expertise, so I apologize if I get this number wrong, but I believe it was about 5,000 years ago. I mean, it's a substantially long period of time. These are people who went from being nomadic hunter-gatherers, just basically cave people, one up from that, if that even, to all of a sudden knowing how to create indoor plumbing, knowing how to have universities and libraries and modern medicine and a system of writing and a system of government basically overnight. They went from killing wildlife and picking berries to wide-scale agrarian farming, domestication of animals, just a huge turnaround. And they attribute that enormous turnaround, that huge influx of technology, to aliens. They call them gods with a small g, multiple s, and they said that these gods came down from the sky. They flew around in spacecraft. They walked among them. They looked an awful lot like people, but it was very clear that they weren't. They had kind of a glow about them, and they wanted gold, and they interbred with humans on Earth and basically spent time here until they had enough of the resources that they needed, and then they left. And I believe there was some debate when they were leaving about whether they should just get rid of humans because we were not quite, they kind of made us in a rush, we were not quite what we ought to be, or whether they should just leave us to our own devices. And apparently the leaving us to our own devices argument won out because we're still here.
Well, that's interesting. I wonder in the history that's been written since, if they were ever written out of the history, because it seems that it's very consistent, and not only in written documents throughout history, but in people's testimonials, there have been stories and folklore about encountering UFOs, extraterrestrial beings throughout the whole entire human history. So,
oh, look, it gets better than that. I mean, the Bible is one of the most read books in the world. You go back to the Old Testament in the Bible, it says things like Adam and Eve being in the Garden of Eden. Well, the Sumerian tablets, written many years before Christ, B.C., these Sumerian tablets talk about the Adamu living in the Eden instead of Adam living in the Garden of Eden. I mean, there are direct corollaries from those to modern writings. There is a flood myth in just about every mythology or every history of every people in the world, people who would have no way of communicating with each other to be able to spread that myth. There are events that are recorded that are very clearly prevalent across all cultures in the world, but mainstream archaeology loves to just dismiss these things as religion, and that's the end of it. They don't ever take them seriously or treat them as histories. It would be like if someone found a book that said the history of the Americas and said, oh, look, it's a book on mythology, even though it says history right across the top, just not believing that it could be a history because it didn't make sense to them. That's basically what we do today with anything we don't understand. We just say, well, it must have some religious significance because I don't understand it, therefore it can't be real.
Well, that's, I think, what we're healing now. That's what I think that the younger people are bringing in, this desire, a genuine desire to know. And I feel very inspired because the mind is opening. The consciousness, I do sense it changing. And there is a genuine hunger for this knowledge. And I feel like everywhere in archaeology, and I like, I've recently been introduced by Graham Hancock. Are you familiar with his work?
Yes, I am.
I really appreciate his work because he does a really nice job of interweaving the rigidity, but he stays on point. You know, he stays on point, which has taught me a lot because I have really, I think it's a great time now to bring in the whole story. And so the extraterrestrial community has always been a part of our humanity, except for this very short period when you step back from the big picture where it's been omitted for various reasons that we can visit if we want or not. It seems like it's kind of an easy thing in that context to patch, you know, like a bypass. Mm. Maybe just a couple of hundred years ago when we were much more in tune with the planet, much more in tune, maybe even with each other, much more in tune with the extraterrestrial influence. At least it didn't have the fear context that it has now. Perhaps it's easier to dissolve that than it looks.
Well, I think a lot of it is labeling, too. We say extraterrestrial, where once upon a time they'd say alien or ghost, or sorry, they would say angel instead of alien, or they would say ghost instead of UFO. Or it's just giving ourselves the vocabulary to be able to explain these things so that you don't just lump anything that doesn't make sense into a category that doesn't necessarily fit.
Yeah, can throw away your television and help you with that. The media doesn't really.
I was going to say, I think you're making an incredibly valid point that we are getting to a stage now where we need to start being able to talk about these things and have a real debate and discuss them openly. I think you're exactly right on that.
How do you think we could do that?
Well, I think the Star Child, and I know that this is a project that I'm heavily involved in, so I have to freely admit my bias, but I really do think that it can legitimately be a way to open that door. It's something that you can't argue with. DNA says what it says, no matter how many people look at it, no matter how many different ways you look at it, it's always going to have the same result. It's something that was alive 900 years ago, so it's not an immediate scary kind of a threat. It's something that we can look at academically without feeling really frightened or intimidated or whatever else, because we know it was here, we know it didn't hurt us, we know life has continued for the better part of 1,000 years thereafter. So it takes a lot of that fear away. And at the same time as that, we've got a lot of different communities around the world, from the religious community with people like the Pope coming out and saying aliens are probably out there and that's okay, that's just some bigger part of God, and different governments coming out and saying we're aware of UFOs, they haven't done anything to hurt us yet, it's something we maybe need to look at it in more detail, especially things like the Mexican government, the French government coming out and releasing their records last year. I think that a lot of the world is really trying to move toward this, or at least lay the groundwork to be moved toward it. And I think America, if anything, is the most stubborn country at not really wanting to give ground on that. Maybe it has something to do with all of the movies and the TV shows that are basically fear-mongering against aliens. Although, in all fairness, some of them are getting to be really quite good, like the Ancient Aliens program is probably the least biased that I've ever seen. They're really starting to just get a little toe in the door, just making it more okay for people to discuss this stuff around the dinner table without having to make a joke about it or without having to pretend like it's not real. We're actually able to have an honest discussion for once.
Yeah, and I think that changing the context from, you know, needing a big ship and, you know, all the drama that's attached to the extraterrestrial in the punch, you know, in the punchline that, or the tagline that gets sent across, that could be changed a bit too, is because, I mean, you might know an alien and you don't even know that they are, because the Pleiadians, I've been told, and I have a feeling I've actually met more than one. They don't even tell you, you know, and they look just like us, or they have a presence that it can. They really do have a. They can be standing in your house, and you might not know it. So I think that the whole context of what an alien is could be revisited as well to make it more familiar to people, because they don't always just come in ships, and they don't always look like the Star Child either. You know, some of them look quite normal. But I agree, the Star Child skull is a really good launching pad for a very gentle discussion, because it is not threatening in that context.
It is not threatening, and it is provable. It's an unfortunate fact, and people don't really like to talk about it, but amongst all of the accounts of alien and UFO encounters, there are certainly a lot of them that are truthful, that are provable, that have a lot of evidence behind them. And then there are some where there are maybe some mental illness involved, or just some look at me syndrome involved, where people make things up or exaggerate things, or do things that are maybe designed to make them money as opposed to get people closer to an actual answer. And unfortunately, anytime someone wants to do real research, you have to wade through this quagmire of charlatans that have come across and given everyone a bad reputation. And it makes it so easy to dismiss the real work that's being done because one or two people made something up at some point and got caught out doing it. It really makes it harder. And I think that a big part of disclosure, of changing the consciousness, of changing the context of the debate, is going to come down to finding a way to weed out the people who are telling the truth from the ones that aren't, so that things like the Star Child, where there really is no way to refute it. There's a point at which we have the whole genome, and it doesn't matter who you are or what you believe, it still says what it says. There's just got to be more and more pieces of evidence and more people like that where there is no dispute. There is no way to say that it's faked or that they're lying or whatever else. And, I want to be really clear. There are a lot of people who are absolutely telling the truth who sometimes aren't taken seriously or aren't believed in the way that they ought to be. But we all know that there are people who are just in it for money or attention, and that really muddies the water for everyone else that's out there. So I think things like the Star Child, where there can be no dispute that it really is genuine, I think that's going to be what it takes to open that door and open the discussion properly.
And I wonder if you visit with us the idea of allowing people their own process, because I think it connects to what you were saying about how charlatans spoil the water and, you know, mixed motives and all these things. But it also spoils the water for allowing our imagination to engage and allowing in each other the opportunity to, you know, take it wherever it goes. And, you know, the object isn't really to be right about it. I mean, the object is to explore and to live life more fully, to allow meaning. And I wonder if you could visit with us that, because, you know, that you use the term mental illness now. Ooh, that's the taboo, right? Nobody wants to be mentally ill. Oh, forbid, you know, but, frankly, I think that it seems to me that denying our imagination the opportunity to just be with the alien, what is that? What is this whole phenomenon? Actually, I think that repression has a part in creating a mentally unbalanced state. So how might the Star Child allow us to play with that and just allow us to be free mentally, to just explore? Do you know what I mean?
No, I do know what you mean, and I think it's really important to make that distinction between someone that's being falsely diagnosed as being mentally ill just because they don't see things the same way everyone else does. I mean, Galileo and Da Vinci and everyone that's ever done anything through history would probably have been committed by certain overzealous people if they had the opportunity, because when you think outside of the box, sometimes people get scared and they like to say, okay, there's something wrong with you because you think differently than me. And that's really not what I'm talking about. That is just a horrible kind of oppression and discrimination that needs to be removed from our world. But there are people who are genuinely mentally ill, who see things that really truly are not there, and they really truly do need help. And unfortunately, they aren't always given the opportunity to access that kind of help. So that's what I'm talking about, weeding out the differences between someone who needs help and somebody who is just thinking in a different way than everyone else does. And thinking differently, not a bad thing. Having a real medical problem that you want treatment for and not being able to get it, that is a bad thing. So I just want to be really clear on that distinction, that I don't think it's a majority of cases at all of people who see things that really aren't there. But unfortunately, a lot of people who see things that are there get lumped into that same boat. And it's going to be, I think, freeing and liberating for everyone that has had these experiences or who has seen things or who has felt things to be able to say, this is what I've seen and this is what I've experienced, without people having to find an excuse, a way to ridicule them or dismiss it so that they're not threatened, because now this is a possibility and everyone just has to be a little more open-minded about it.
I really appreciate the opportunity that the Star Child brings to us, and I feel like humanity's ready for it too. I do. I feel like we're all just aching for a break in the denial. It doesn't really, you know, wherever you're sitting in this whole mess, everybody has some contention with the repression and even the go along and do everything you're told, people are not satisfied now. You know, it's really, we're all just ready to explode this. And so it is nice that the Star Child skull just kind of sits there apparently, or appearingly docile, and it's, you know, it's just a skull, right?
Yes, it's a skull, which is a little scary in and of itself, but it's not going to jump up and demand that it be made the ruler of the world, or I don't think it's going to be asking us to take it to our leader anytime soon or anything like that.
And even the physical characteristics are stunning, you know, and I so respect Lloyd's work. I mean, there's no accident that he got this job. You know, he's really on the mark of where he needs to take it to bring this into this place of undisputability, and I fully respect that. But for people who are even, you know, for people who are open-minded and who are ready to move into this conversation now, we don't, you know, have to wait for the DNA. You know, just looking at that skull, taking into consideration the genuine differences that are so obvious. It's obvious. It really, you know, doesn't need a DNA for a lot of people who are willing to sit down with an open mind, with an open heart, and just really be with that as a possibility, which is what I really wanted to really, really feel like is the opportunity to bring to the listeners, is that we really do have an opportunity now to shift our consciousness, and we can go now. We don't have to wait for the establishment to tell us, you know, DNA is proof ready. And some people want that, and it needs to have its process. But, you know, it is possible to just look at that skull and just be with that as a possibility and go, wow, you know, I think I can work with this, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And for anyone out there that is looking for a little more ammunition to help open this debate, there's a lot of information at starchildproject.com, starchildproject.com. And we have a whole bunch of the reports that have been done and just a bunch of things that will really help you be able to explain this to someone in the kind of way that we're just sitting around and talking now. It's really a great resource.
What are some of the things about the Star Child skull that stand out to you as the most striking, that really stuck in your mind, that really caused that shift?
Well, I was in university when I was first involved with the project. I was an archaeology student, and I was actually working my way through college as a dental assistant and at a dental surgery in Australia. And I was very familiar with the anatomy and the physiology the way it ought to be in a face, and especially in teeth and in mouths. And while most of the front of the Star Child skull's face has been broken off, we do have a small fragment of maxilla. That's the upper jawbone, the part right underneath your nose. And the teeth that were inside that bone, there were two teeth that were erupted. They, you know, they were sticking out just like normal teeth. And then there were several teeth that were unerupted that were up inside the bone, like when you have your baby teeth that are already out, you're waiting for your adult teeth to come in. Well, they had that in the x-ray. But when you looked at the teeth, they were just ground down. I mean, ground more than a child could do. Even if you had a five-year-old who did nothing but just tried to eat rocks all day, they've got young little jaws. They just don't have the strength in their chewing muscles to be able to do this kind of damage to their teeth. And so I was looking at that and thinking, my gosh, how old was this being when it died? Humans usually only get one set of adult teeth. There are certainly cases of people who do get more than one set of teeth, or usually it's just a few of your teeth that come in twice, like you'd get your front teeth twice instead of just once. Your adult teeth would fall out and you'd get another set after that. So it's not unheard of. But in the case of the star child skull, I was just looking at it and I was baffled. The teeth didn't really look like baby teeth to me. The amount of wear on the teeth didn't look like they could belong to a child. So I was just really confused and intrigued by how old it must have been when it died. And then, of course, there's the usual thing like you or me or your average person is going to have about 1,400 cubic centimeters of brain. A being about the size of the star child should have about 1,200 cubic centimeters. The star child skull actually has 1,600 cubic centimeters, so it has a much bigger brain than what we have. It just really seemed to me like something that we needed to understand. We needed to be able to find out what was different about the skull and what can we use from that in terms of making medicine for ourselves. Are we going to be able to forget about dentures one day because you can go to the doctor and you can get a shot and you're going to grow a new set of teeth? Or I'm sure you're aware of the savants. They're people who are often very severely impaired in most of their brain function, but they have one area like math or music or something else where they're an absolute virtuoso. They're just genius at this one thing, but they can barely function in every other way. Well, according to these Sumerian writings and the works of Lloyd Pye and his book Everything You Know Is Wrong and Zechariah Sitchin's work, the reason that we have those people is that the Anunnaki are actually substantially smarter than we are, maybe 100 times smarter than we are, maybe 10 times smarter than we are, but much more than we are. Humans only ever use about 10% of our brain power. So in those savants, maybe that curtain that gets pulled down so we can't use the other half of the other 90% of our brain power, maybe there's just a little hole in that curtain, or maybe the curtain's in the wrong spot. Maybe if we found a way to disable that kind of stupidity clause that got built into our DNA so we could only ever use 10% of our brain, maybe if there's a way to just switch that other 90% on. Could you imagine what we could do if we were all just suddenly woke up one day and we're 10 times smarter than we were the day before? The possibilities in the skull are really endless, and that's what got me excited and got me thinking we need to do something with this. We need to find out what it really is.
Huh, that's interesting. So it stimulated all those kinds of thinking in your experience with it. That's really rich. That's fantastic. And what is your knowledge of the Anunnaki, and how are the Anunnaki bad guys? Are they good guys? I mean, is it a good thing to be seeded from Anunnaki? I've only heard a lot of bad guy stories.
Well, for anyone that's familiar with any of the Grecian or Roman mythology, they talk about their gods as being very human-like. They've got the same afflictions of greed and jealousy and violence and backstabbing, and just basically they're like normal people, but they are gods. The Anunnaki are described the same way. They're described as very much like people in the way that they react and interact with each other. And I think that we really are just a product of that. I'm not saying that there's not violence in the animal kingdom or elsewhere. There's always territorial disputes and other problems. But we seem to have a really unique ability to cause each other to suffer and to neglect helping people that we have a capacity to help. And I mean, especially in the Western world, we have this whole suite of diseases now that you can't get unless you are eating too much of foods that aren't good for you. Mm. That's never happened before in the history of the world. No one's ever been this gluttonous or this wasteful or this anything. And I really think that a lot of that feeds back into the society and the genetics of where we came from. It's always a nature-nurture debate, how much of it's genetic and how much of it is being brought up in the same way. But anyone who has brothers and or sisters who are just completely different personality types from them will tell you that a lot of it really is genetic. And I think that I don't know that there is any extraterrestrial culture out there that's just perfectly peaceful all the time, like, I don't know, like the Vulcans or someone that's just good always. I think that we got a lot of that, I guess you'd call it bad personality traits, passed down to us genetically. But I think that at the same time, it's a choice whether you permit that to be expressed or not. So I think it didn't necessarily set us up in the best way possible to be the best people possible. But I think at the same time, we're making a lot of choices that aren't improving our situation at all.
And that's exactly where consciousness comes in, the ability to make choices. What is that part then that makes us decide whether we're going to go to McDonald's today or not? You know, and that's also a place where genetics, the consciousness and the genetic meeting place. Is it the body, the genetics that tell the path, or is it the consciousness that tell the body? You know, is the body the machine? Or is the consciousness driving the machine, or is the machine driving itself using the consciousness?
Well, that's a tough one, and I think that's another one of those tricky situations where there is no one-size-fits-all answer. I think that you mentioned McDonald's, and food in particular is a tricky one, because anything that you put into your body or that you expose your body to, your brain can become addicted to it, and that takes away a lot of your ability to have a conscious choice over it. You can still do it. It's just a lot harder than making a choice about something that you don't have any kind of addiction to. But then you get back to being able to argue about where did you get the propensity for having an addiction. Really, there's a lot of questions to be asked about if we could change things about ourselves, should we, and how much would we want to? I mean, if we did find out that all of these bad traits that we have, maybe the Anunnaki are the only warlike culture anywhere in the cosmos, and we just happen to inherit something that makes us the same way, and maybe there's a shot we can all get where all of a sudden no one's going to be aggressive anymore. Well, would we want to do that? Would we want to alter that level of consciousness?
And then deny it. It's perhaps just deny the opportunity to evolve in another way, perhaps. Because if we've already come this far from, you know, why is as barbaric as we are today, and I still think we are operating in large degrees of barbarism personally, we are still much farther along than we were even 50 years ago. You know, at least I can go to the south of America and I do not see black bathrooms and white bathrooms. Now, we haven't fully healed the prejudice attached to that, but I can still give full credit for that advancement in consciousness that that we don't see that and that the it just taking racism as a measure of how we can heal things and balance things other than, you know, the quick fix shock thing, you know?
What, to properly understand anything like that is a really long and drawn-out discussion. But the roots of that racism come from religious leaders basically saying that, interpreting passages in the Bible that said that devils and people from hell are black, and therefore anyone that's black or brown or anything other than white is hell-spawn, and you don't have to treat them the same way that you treat anyone else. So the argument then becomes, why would they listen to these people telling them something that should fly in the face of anyone's morals? even if no one's ever told you it's wrong to kick an animal, if you see someone kicking an animal, you should feel something bad for that. So it gets to be a very complicated question about multiple influences and things that are ingrained in people over generations of doing the same wrong thing over and over again. It's a really tough one. Boy, you're really covering the gamut in this show.
Well, it's time, you know. It's let's make a new world and visit these things and explore this other 90%. Let's find that curtain and pull it. I love the way you said that. Let's pull that curtain and find that the 90% of our brilliance and use it and have some fun with it. You know what we could do is just worth dreaming about, worth working on, worth and, you know, sort of loving towards. I'm really kind of more interested in giving up the fight these days and more interested in moving into the flow, because I feel like the whole universe really does want the human to move that curtain and really be all that we can be. I feel like we've earned it.
Well, I agree. I think some of us have maybe worked a little harder than others toward that end, but you're right. There's a point where you've got to just live and let live and accept that you can't win every battle.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Wow. Well, we have flown by. This hour has been very rich, and I really, really appreciate you taking the time to visit with us. Would you like to offer again the websites, how people might reach you and find out more information about the Star Child, and any closing thoughts?
Absolutely. The website is starchildproject.com. Got plenty of information up there for you. As Jamal mentioned, we do have an ebook which is basically like the Cliff Notes. It's the cheat sheet, everything you need to know about the Star Child in one quick, easy to read package, and it's cheap. It's under $10, so it's worth going ahead and getting that, just to educate yourselves. But a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about tonight is really better covered in Lloyd Pye's work, and that's Lloydpye. So it sounds like apple pie, but it's not spelled the same way. It's P-Y-E. And that's his website, lloydpye.com, and you can go and find a lot more information about some of the really interesting stuff we've been talking about tonight.
Well, thank you so much, Amy, and it's been a pleasure sharing with you, and thank you to all the listeners for tuning in. I hope you've enjoyed the ride, and do take care of yourselves. We will be back in a fortnight. Bye-bye.